This is an opera cast from English National Opera. For more information and to book tickets, visit www.eno.org.
Yeah, let's go for it.
Ed, you're currently conducting Tosca and rehearsing Mozart's great opera seria, Idomeneo. That's a seismic shift in style. I mean, how are you coping with adjusting from one to the other on a daily basis?
Yeah, it's a very good question. The Tosca performances have thinned out now, and it's sort of a month since we've opened, so it's in a lovely place. And, you know, on the days of Tosca shows, I'm very much in that world. But at the moment, I'm doing about... It's probably a Tosca show a week or two a week, and it's and those are on... They're then by no means on consecutive days. And I would describe doing Tosca and Idomeneo as two different careers, not even a seismic shift of style. It really feels like I use completely different parts of my brain for the two things. And I'm actually, going into one from the other, I have to be incredibly aware of what that is.
Yeah.
If you go into Tosca with too much Mozartian energy, I don't think anyone would like the results. And actually, in that way, it makes it much easier to shift between pieces. I've done pieces, you know, maybe a late 19th century piece and an early 20th century piece close together. And that's really hard, because you're talking about the subtleties of style, not something so black and white as these two pieces.
I suppose that in one sense there's a similarity in there. They're both thrillers of the human predicament. You know, there are people in a very, very difficult predicament. You know, in the case of Idomeneo, it's this awful decision that the king finds himself having to make. And with Tosca, it's that, you know, does she give in to the evil Scarpia, or does she stand her ground as Cavaradossi wants her to? And so
thematic links. I think musically, though, on a purely musical level, I don't think they don't connect in any way at all.
Yeah.
But you're right, there are dramatic thematic links. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Being music director of a company as big as this is about so much more than just making music, which, you know, must be another tough adjustment to make. I mean, what are the areas that prove most challenging for you? Because you're at home on the podium.
I think it's really great in an institution like this if an orchestra and chorus can feel like part of a musical family. And I think what I try to do is make sure that they're able to do their best work in every production, not just mine. So, you know, I hope I support the conductors of the other productions as much as they need, you know, other directors to a certain extent, and make sure that, you know, the chorus and the orchestra are really, you know, are really firing on all cylinders for all pieces. I think you have to be... someone said to me before I started that it's two jobs, and... I think at the time I remember thinking that it was... I think I said this to you before, actually, but at the time I remember thinking that it was... They were saying that it's a hell of a lot of work, but they're not. They're saying that you need to actually divide yourself as a person into two different types of people. Mm-hmm. And that's the hardest thing about this job, the management against the musician. And it's really that, you know, on days when you get it wrong, it's not much fun. And on days when it's right, it's... You know, it's great, it's functional, but that's very, very, very hard.
Yes, I remember how difficult Bernard Haitink found it at the Opera House. Sort of, you know, there was a man very much focused on the musical values, and he said it was really tough for him to get involved in other decision-making. But this is...
Yeah.
There's something more intimate about this house.
It operates. I think that's right. Even with an audience, you feel like corporate is a dangerous word to use, but there's a corporate feeling of identity and, you know, direction and sort of, you know, thrust for artistic, you know, artistic greatness. And yeah, everyone gets that. I mean, I think what I try and do is make sure that everyone realizes that any decision that's made managerially is completely artistically informed. And, you know, when I tell myself that as well, it makes it easier to combine.
I suppose you also have to be a bit of a psychologist with... I mean, the singers become your very, very personal... I mean, you nurture them, you support them.
Yeah.
These are very important people in this company.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It, particularly in the case of young artists who you're developing in the young artist scheme. Do you find you have to do a lot of... you know, that kind of pastoral work, if you like, as well as musical work.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, it is with young singers, like, I mean, we have Chris Turner and James Garrett in the Tosca. Sarah Tynan's by no means inexperienced, but you know, she's someone who's come through that system, and yeah. She's really, I mean, she's wonderful, but I think, I mean, all singers need support, and that's, and I think I realise that more every new opera I do. And yeah, you really, my work is to make them feel as confident, as comfortable as possible, as well as, you know, achieving what I need to achieve in with the shapes of the pieces.
Sure, and there's a lot riding on some of these big roles that many of them may not have sung before.
Yeah, that's right.
Your lunch has just arrived as well, Ed, so you can actually chew on that. Your whole background, Ed, as a choral scholar and a choral conductor and then a repetiteur. And, for the benefit of people who don't know about what a repetiteur does, I know that everybody says it's the best grounding for being a conductor, but tell us a little bit about what's involved in that.
So a repetiteur on a very basic level is playing for the production calls of operatic performances, but the best repetiteurs, and this is by no means what I did, I wasn't a great repetiteur. The best repetiteurs, and we have a lot of them here, are able to sort of realise the orchestral sound of great scores. You know, Strauss operas, Puccini operas we've just been doing with Richard Pearson, who's just such a wonderful player. The sort of weight of the orchestral sound, the colours of it.
In a piano.
Yes. And I mean, and amazingly astute things on top of that, like trying to recreate the millisecond the orchestra plays behind the beat. Things like that. And it's amazing. And I feel like if I work with a great repetiteur, I'm getting the orchestral sound into my body, and the singers are getting the underpinning of what the orchestral sound will be. Because we're rehearsing in a studio for 5 weeks. The singers may only rehearse before they start doing it on stage. They may only rehearse with the orchestra for 6 hours. And that's, the proportions are kind of crazy when you put it like that. So what we do in a rehearsal room is try and give them the support and try and give them an idea of what to expect, I suppose. Mm. And repetiteurs are coaches as well. They coach the singers a lot.
And working with singers, of course, is the best, gives you the best understanding of what it is, how music breathes and how phrasing works.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because the human voice is the key to it all, isn't it, really?
The human voice is the key to it all. And I've always been kind of obsessional about accompanying. And at one point I thought I might do piano accompanying, actually, very early on. And it is. And it's such a... As a conductor, you know, I try in my basic way to get back to playing in the company when I can with whatever sessions I have in rehearsals, because it's a visceral connection you have. You know, you're really making sound in a completely different way as you might conduct an orchestra, and I think it's always good to connect to that with a singer. I think that's very important.
Mm-hmm. How do you think your operatic work informs your concert work? Because, I mean, you do a great deal of symphonic conducting as well. Very successfully, I've heard some really marvellous performances of yours. I remember Enigma Variations of the Proms particularly. Really fine.
Thank you.
So how do you think that... Because I suppose everything in music is essentially theatrical, isn't it?
I would say there are two composers who I didn't... I was very young, so I had every right to be very scared of them. But I, the symphonies of Mozart and the symphonies of Tchaikovsky, when I was really starting out, I couldn't see what I would do with them. I couldn't see how I would bring anything to these pieces. And then, through a knowledge of the Mozart operas, and through a knowledge of Onegin, actually, strangely, it began to inform what you can do and what a gesture meant, you know, on a very emotional level and on a dramatic level, and it really helped me. And I think my symphonic work came from conducting opera, any kind of ability I have in symphonic work. But I do think it's gone into a different discipline. I think it sort of exists side by side. I wouldn't say that I try and conduct symphonies like opera, but I do try and find dramatic shape with everything. And I think that's it. That's where I come from.
I do remember a marvellous pianist, Mitsuko Uchida, saying to me that she felt that pianists had no business playing the Mozart piano concertos if they didn't know the operas and the symphonies.
That's very interesting.
And you see her, you see this woman at concerts.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's, it's bears up a lot of what you're saying. I'm really looking forward to your Dream of Gerontius next season.
Yes,
that's something
me too.
Because that's a very... I mean, you could almost stage that piece.
And there have been conversations about that very thing. And it's a piece... I mean, having been a chorister in Gloucester, it's a piece I'm very close to. I conducted it very, very early on, bizarrely. I mean, I sang it as a boy, of course, many times. But I conducted it very early on in my career. And I went through the score... with John Sanders, who was then organist at Gloucester Cathedral, where I was a chorister, and he'd played the organ in performances for Herbert Sumption, and Herbert Sumption had played organ for Elgar, and I really felt going through it with him that he really understood that music.
Continuity.
Yeah. He understood it on a level that I never underestimated, but it resonates with me now, even listening to the great Elgar conductors conducting the symphonies. I remember the small things he said to me about those extraordinary, those precise markings, that almost neurotic markings that Elgar puts in every bar, the tenutos, those little tin hat accents, the phrasing. Yeah.
Really, really important in these pieces, aren't they?
And
because it's all to do with the way it breathes, again.
The way it breathes, yeah. The way it breathes, and I would go even further, the way it breathes and the colour of the music, extraordinary orchestration.
Great piece. Funny enough, it's when you're looking at Elgar pieces on the page, they are quite complex as well, because usually a lot of divided strings and things that don't look as they sound, which is weird, I always think.
Yes.
I've tried following those pieces, the symphonies, for example.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Gerontius has that as well. It has a sort of... I mean, it's not dissimilar to Puccini's writing, and I'm a huge advocate for the extraordinary skill of Puccini's orchestration. I can stare at those scores for hours. It's sort of it's quite nebulous on the page, but the transparency that you should be able to get out of it is amazing. And thinking of the prelude for Gerontius, it's the same it's the same world.
Mm. Let's talk a bit about Idomeneo. It's a work which became a victim of fashion, I suppose, and as opposed to a fashion victim, when the style kind of went, opera seria went out of vogue. It's now commanding a rightful place at the heart of the repertoire. And is it a piece that you've been aching to do?
It is. I've always been amazed by it. It's a piece I've been very scared of doing. I think it's very hard to cast in most of the roles, actually. I think it's very hard to direct, because it's... I mean, the language, the Ferrescan libretto, it's not easy, and it's not necessarily logical some of the time. And to give this impression of these all-powerful gods, rather like something like Iphigenia on Oli, the idea that you can build up this extraordinarily dramatic situation which can be undercut by the gods at any time. I think that's very hard, to get a sense of the real strength of the gods and the strength of this human vow to the gods. But we've had the most wonderful time doing it. Katie's doing an extraordinary job with it. The cast we have is just wonderful, led by Paul Nylon with Emma Bell and Sarah Tynan. And I'm just so thrilled we have... a tenor adamante,
that's a good point. I mean, what was that ever a question mark in your head? Because it can be
yes,
cast.
It was. It was, and it has mostly. I would say historically, it's mostly been cast as a. I mean, it's a soprano castrato role. It's mostly been cast as a mezzo. I have to say that I think it's incredibly hard to make it work as a mezzo soprano, both with the artifice of the traversy role, the trouser role. But also, it's incredibly high. It's written incredibly high, and even in these second recitatives, which have to feel natural, it's around Fs, Ds to Fs all the time. And I've never listened to it and thought that it fits satisfactorily with a mezzo. And we're lucky that Mozart wrote a version for tenor, because it gives us license to look at that avenue, and it opens up the piece to me in a completely different way.
Well, you've got Robert Murray, haven't you?
Yeah.
Which is, and that's a totally different colour from Paul's.
Exactly, yeah.
And the idea of the heroic coloratura of,
yeah.
of the title role,
yeah.
That's one of the things that went out of fashion, because as tenors developed, they became more about what we now associate them with in the Italian Verismo, and you know, the,
yeah.
And they didn't have to move the voice as much. This role is full of very, very difficult, as well as the other stuff as well. But it, I mean, it does have this heroic.
Yes, it does.
Ability to it.
And I mean, it's to do partly, I guess, with the fact that the original Domino was quite an older man, and you know, he had a real a status about him. But the great Allegro Fuor del Mar in Act Two is maestoso, you know, and the way Paul sings it, I think. Is revelatory, because he really articulates every single one of those semiquavers. I mean, it's extraordinary. It has this power and presence that you don't associate with later Italian
yeah.
repertoire. You know, when you think of bel canto and the lightness of coloratura, it's an incredibly individual style, and I think Paul realizes it wonderfully.
Well, it probably keeps his voice healthy as well, because. You know, when you're shifting into that slightly more heroic repertoire, there's a danger that, well, you're in dangerous waters then.
Yeah.
I mean, this old guy who sang it originally must have had quite a technique. I mean, he wouldn't have been able to get around it otherwise.
No.
Old or not.
And he was incredibly demanding to Mozart about how many arias he should have in the first place. I don't think Fuor del Mar existed in the first... At least it wasn't in the first batch of work that Mozart had written when he was first showing the singers. And he was astonished when he finally got the aria, I think. You're right, it's an extraordinarily large-scale piece of coloratura work to perform in the middle of a big evening, I would say.
But then at the end, of course, he has that wonderful aria, the end of the piece. In fact, there are wonderful things in the last act, the quartet, and the extraordinary ballet that ends the whole evening. I mean, that, again, is something quite out there.
Yeah,
I mean, what I'm interested to know what Katie, who's known for her multimedia work,
yes.
is she using any of those elements?
Yeah, but it's done in a I think it's done in the most beautifully discreet way. It has elements of all that you might expect from her work, but never it's never heavily layered. And we're not actually doing the ballet at all.
Oh right, okay. Now this is a big decision.
Yeah, it is, and it's a decision we didn't take lightly. But I talked to lots of people about it. I talked to Charles McCarris a lot about the piece. And, I mean, it's very... We wanted... Katie and I wanted the piece to end with the last dramatic breath. And the ballet music is extremely beautiful, but for a modern audience in a theatre like this, we felt it was a very dangerous thing to do.
Well, there's
actually.
A lot of it.
There's
start.
A hell of a lot of
and,
it.
And you've almost got to devise
yeah.
an epilogue, haven't you?
You do, exactly. And when you already have an epilogue written in, this happy ending, you know, it's very short, but it is in itself an epilogue. And then, you know, you start talking about a cut version of the ballet, but, you know, what's the point? We just felt, finish it with the end of the drama.
Mm. In a cutting-edge company like this, where, you know, we've got a lineup for the new season of some amazing directors, I mean, inevitably there are going to be times when your view of the piece will not match that of the director you're working with, but presumably, I mean, that's one of the joys of being in this job, is that
yeah.
you actually... have to be much more open-minded and without preconceptions about these pieces when you come to perform them with
yes.
great directors.
Yes.
But, I mean, I'm presuming that only if it affected your musical values would you have a contretemps or intervene with a director and say, look, this is just not going to work.
That's a very big question, and I kind of answer it in parts. I think... I've worked with great directors here who inform what I do as much as the music informs what they do. People like Richard Jones and Deborah Warley, you know, David McVicar for Clemente and Rosencavalier. I mean, it's these are great operatic directors. I have discussions with directors incredibly early on in the process to make sure that they understand what my viewpoint of whatever work it is as a dramatic entity is. To help us discover something together, because that's kind of why I do it anyway. That, you know, what two people, what a director and conductor can do with a piece is great, should be greater than, you know, any other art form, that kind of that binding together of the stage and the pit. I think contretemps do happen, of course, because you can have a very specific idea about how music goes or how it ought to look as a director or even as a conductor. And no, I never separate what I do in purely musical terms. So anything that happens on the stage is going to affect how the music sounds, and anything I do is going to affect how it's staged. So even with the directors I've adored working with, there have been times when we've had heated discussions about things, and that's part of it. But as you say, you've got to keep an open mind. You can't, it's not up to me to tell them how to direct a piece. Yeah. You engage great directors to do great directing.
Yes. I'm interested, you say you start the discussions away in advance.
Yeah.
In the coming season, for example, we're, I think it's a nice idea doing two different takes on the Faust version.
Yeah.
Opening the season with the Gounod, directed by a man who's done a huge amount of work in music theatre, Des McAnuff.
Yeah.
Including many of musicals that I've seen, because that's a passion of mine. Mm. And of course Terry Gilliam, the one that everybody's hugely anticipating. I mean, what kind of advice has, for example, Terry been asking of you in advance of the show? Has he asked you what is possible on the stage? What is...
Yeah, very much. And size of choruses for individual scenes. I mean, very logistical things. And he has, as you would imagine, for someone with that imagination, a thousand ideas to throw at every bar of the piece. And actually, it's, you know, alongside the producers and the costume department, it's working through what we can do, what we can do and what will make sense. And soon, actually, in the next few weeks, Terry and I will go through the score, and I'll play it through and tell him how it feels. And repetition. Actually, directors who come to opera for the first time are really worried about repetition, and it's part of my job to assure them that it doesn't sound repetitious when you put it on a stage. It's just part of the form, and you know, there's the development through repetition itself in opera, which you don't get in film or lots of stage work, I'd say.
Yeah, you're working in such tiny fragments in film, although they have to make a complete whole.
Yeah.
The focus is quite different.
It is, it's very different.
Oh, fascinating.
But actually, with both Des and Terry, Des has done large-scale musicals, as you say, and Terry, of course, has been associated with film for a long time. They both come with extraordinarily sharp vision, which is amazing, actually. There's no sense of wait and see.
No, well, I mean, you know, the director of such shows as Tommy and Jersey Boys, where, I mean, you have to be precisely focused. I mean, these pieces, even more so than opera, where there is a certain musical weight and extravagance that can hold its own. Mm. But in these pieces, they're much more fragile, I think, and if you get the staging wrong...
Yeah.
You get the storytelling wrong. You're
yes,
in big
absolutely,
trouble.
Absolutely.
What are you? I mean, it's great that you're conducting both the Faust pieces. What else are you particularly? Is your appetite whetted by later in the season?
But conducting Boccanegra for me is a huge thing, because it's a piece I've loved for a long time.
What a great piece!
I really wanted to do another late, big, dark Verdi, and you know, we've put together such a great cast. That's something I'm really thrilled by doing. And meeting Dimitri, I think he's going to make a real impression.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just work this out. It'll be the first time he's done a new production in this country. Although I think his Onegin is travelling here to Covent Garden.
The Bolshoi.
Yeah. But he's a very interesting guy. I'm very excited to work with him, actually. Yeah.
Boccanegra is fascinating in the sense that revision turned it into a completely different opera.
Yes.
I mean, if ever anyone wanted an illustration of how a composer's second thoughts, by the addition of that one scene, the council chamber scene, completely transforms the opera.
Yeah, absolutely right. And it was, am I right in thinking that Covent Garden did both side by side about a decade ago?
They did, and Mark Helder, he did the earlier version,
yeah.
And tried very hard to sell it to me, and I said, I'm sorry, Mark, but once I'd seen the revision, I found the earlier version quite you know, moribund.
Oh, really?
Really.
Yeah.
It's just those little things that he changed, and that one big thing.
Yeah. I mean, actually, going back to Idomeneo and talking about revisions, this whole Munich to Vienna thing, I don't think you could be that... I don't think you can be that specific about revision being a great thing. And it's...
Yeah.
You know, this, that piece exists in so many slightly fragmented forms, and unusually for Mozart, we have such a clear documentation of how it was discussed with the librettist and in rehearsal. It feels like that over those few years was a living work of art that could move in any direction. I mean, actually, we've grappled a lot with putting a few recitatives back in. There's a recitative for Abbace and Idomeneo right at the beginning of Act Two, which we put back in from the original version, because that bit of story is totally lost, actually, in the Vienna revision.
And the aria you cut of Abbace, they're using in the Classical Opera Company, are using in Zaida.
Fantastic.
As a completion in the last act.
So it's going to be in London in some form.
Yes,
that's great.
There you are. Isn't that weird?
Yes.
I suppose composers anyway, they, you know, revisions are often about commercial pressure.
Of course, yeah.
We need a ballet, or we need a few more arias because this singer demands an extra aria.
Yeah.
I mean, we forget how practical these guys had to
be. Yeah, and it's hard to know how we can delve into that practicality. I mean, I tend to be as puritanical as I can about, you know, what exists. But Idomeneo, you have to make your decisions. You really do. And Charles McCarris is wonderful about that, actually, about what he's done in the various incarnations of the piece he's been involved with. Mm. And they were very practical, but what I find fascinating is when Mozart absolutely put his foot down about, you know, vowel sounds that Varesco produced, too many E's in an aria for Elia. Too many I's, I mean, written I's. Thunder in the middle of arias, he thought was a ridiculous idea. Asides in the middle of arias, he thought were dramatically completely inept. And this thing, this quartet in Act Three, the singers were furious that it wasn't the time that they had their Chopin's arias, and he insisted and insisted, and what we're left with is one of the great, great bits of Mozart.
Isn't it just? Now you're a very busy man, and now you've got a little boy as well, which is adding to that busyness. Do you manage to get, because in a house like this, obviously, the theatrical factor is huge. Do you manage to get to see things? Do you manage to go to the theatre as much as you would like, or are you too...
At the moment, it's such a huge period of V&O work that at the moment I'm here most nights, and there's very little I get to see. I'm going to the ballet on Thursday to see Jeremy Talbot's arrangement at Covent Garden. I'm going to go down. I can't make a single day to Billy Bunny's Lion Ball, which I'm really disappointed.
You should
about.
Be gutted about that.
Yeah, I am.
It's
but
wonderful.
I'm going to go to. I'll get to Don Giovanni later in the season, which I'm extremely excited about.
Yeah.
You've got to plan it in a way I've never had to before. In the past, I had a free evening, and I just you know, go down to the theatre. But it's slightly different now.
Just a few words to as we're getting to the point where you've got to have your sandwich and get back to rehearsal. About young singers allowing them to flex their creative muscles and the young artist scheme here. I mean, is there something particular about the scheme here that's different from other theatres, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a lot about how we nurture singers properly and whether, you know, in the scheme we've just moved away from, it was about having people on quite a rigid contract staying here and finding roles within the operas for them. What we found is that we ended up giving people roles that might not suit them, giving them covers that might not suit them. And I think what we've come up with is something a little bit more flexible, but will have a stronger commitment from the singers and from us to the singers, and just allow them to sing the right repertoire. And, you know, the care here from John McMurray and the repetitors and Martin Fitzpatrick, the head of music, and I hope from me as well, it's really wonderful. And we can help these singers develop in the right way. But I think schemes that are based in some capacity on the contracted German system are, by their nature, a massive compromise. And I think they can be very, very dangerous for young singers. And I hope we can create something that allows them to develop in the way that they really ought to.
Yeah, you're right. A duty of care is critical, because there's nothing more fragile or easily misdirected than the operatic human voice.
I think that's right. And, you know, what tends to happen in those sort of